From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As NATO troops capture alleged war criminals in former Yugoslavia, we look at an alleged war criminal here at home. Today, for the first time, we reveal the whereabouts of Haitian Death Squad leader Emmanuel Constant and the secret deal he struck with the U.S. government to remain here.
Emmanuel Constant is the leader of the Haitian political and paramilitary organization called FRAP, dubbed a terrorist organization by the U.S. State Department, and accused of killing thousands of Haitians.
And a conversation with Congressmember John Conyers, just returned from Haiti. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A war criminal convicted of torturing and killing his neighbors during the Bosnian conflict was sentenced to 20 years in prison today at The Hague. Dusan Tadic, a 41-year-old Bosnian Serb, has been found guilty on May 7th of 5 war crimes and 6 crimes against humanity for atrocities in the Prijedor region of northwest Bosnia in 1992. He'd faced a maximum sentence of life imprisonment. Tadic stood calmly in court with a slight smile on his face as presiding judge Gabriel Kirk MacDonald read out the sentences today during a 12-minute hearing. In Pittsburgh, NAACP Chair Merle Evers Williams exhorted more than 3,000 members Sunday night to shake off the yoke of apathy and help return the organization to social and political prominence. The 1995 death of black motorist Johnny Gamage while in custody of suburban Pittsburgh police is a rallying point for both delegates inside and protesters outside the NAACP's 88th annual convention. Police Brutality, a Community Response, was the name of a workshop. No recent issue has struck the city's black community like the death and subsequent dismissal of manslaughter charges against 2 Brentwood, Pennsylvania police officers accused of killing Johnny Gamage in a fight after a traffic stop in October of 1995. Outside the David L. Lawrence Convention Center, more than 24 protesters distributed flyers over the incident. One local NAACP member said, "We don't think a city as evil as Pittsburgh should have the honor of playing host." NAACP President Kwesi Mfume said the delegates planned a rally and march tomorrow to protest the handling of the Gamage case. But while sharing concerns of the protesters, he said, "We don't share their logic." This news from Birmingham, Alabama. A man questioned last week by investigators who reopened the investigation into the 1963 Birmingham church bombing that killed 4 black girls has again denied involvement. Bobby Frank Cherry, now living in Texas, was interviewed by the FBI on Wednesday as it reopened the case after a secret year-long review. 4 black girls died and 20 other people were hurt in the racially motivated bombing attributed to the Ku Klux Klan. Only one person, Robert Chambliss, was convicted, but authorities always believed more were involved. A state grand jury in Oklahoma City is set to begin hearing testimony today to determine whether anyone else was involved in the Oklahoma City bombing. Among the questions the Oklahoma panel is expected to consider is whether the government knew about the attack in advance. The blast killed 168 people and injured hundreds more in April of 1995. Several potential witnesses say they saw McVeigh with others the morning of the bombing, and some say federal agents were aware of a bombing plot. Charles Kay, an Oklahoma state representative who petitioned for the new grand jury, says he's anxious for an investigation to, quote, reveal the truth. Microsoft Corporation Chair Bill Gates topped Forbes magazine's list of the world's top billionaires for the third straight year, and he's pulling away from the pack as his software empire rides the stock market's record-setting wave. Gates' net worth doubled to $36.4 billion over the past year. That put him nearly $9 billion ahead of the second-place Walton family, the $27.6 billion heirs to the Walmart fortune. This according to Forbes' 11th annual ranking released yesterday. As the first anniversary of the TWA Flight 800 disaster nears, the government is launching a new effort to find out what happened. Starting today, investigators are going to be running test flights. On a Boeing 747 out of New York's Kennedy Airport, they'll be testing all the theories. 4 of 6 scenarios deal with mechanical problems, 2 deal with theories that the blast was intentional. This news from Nantucket, Massachusetts. They may be demanding campaign finance reforms in Washington, but some top Democrats are making it clear that hobnobbing with wealthy donors is still a way of doing political business. The lawmakers have been weekending in sunny Nantucket, joining supporters for events ranging from birdwatching to sailing and a clam bake hosted by Senator Edward Kennedy. The state's other senator, John Kerry, says 200 people have been spending the weekend at the White Elephant Resort. They gave or were expected to give $20,000 each for a potential take of $4 million. A guest list obtained by the Boston Sunday Globe included two members of the Senate panel investigating fundraising, Robert Torricelli of New Jersey and Max Cleland of Georgia. Torricelli told Fox News Sunday the event wasn't a fundraiser, but as he put it, a gathering of major party supporters. And for the first time in weeks, Palestinian police patrolled downtown Hebron to prevent clashes between Israeli troops and Palestinian stone throwers. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Bill Richardson, is expected to fly to Port-au-Prince, Haiti today. Amid rising protests against World Bank and IMF-imposed austerity measures and the continued occupation of Haiti by 2,000 U.S. and U.N. troops, Richardson is expected to pressure Haitian President René Préval to stick to policies laid out by Washington and appoint a new pro-business prime minister. When President Clinton ordered more than 20,000 troops into Haiti in September of 1994, he told a nationwide television audience that the United States had to move into Haiti to stop human rights abuses and end the three-year military coup that overthrew elected President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Still, nearly 3 years later, not one major figure has been arrested and tried for a crime committed during the military dictatorship of General Raoul Cedras, which claimed an estimated 5,000 lives. Part of the reason has been because the United States has actively blocked any attempts to bring the perpetrators to justice, including allowing some of the worst human rights abusers to live and work here in the United States. Today on Democracy Now!, we reveal for the first time the whereabouts of Emmanuel Constant, the head of the Haitian Death Squad, FRAP, and the deal he struck with the U.S. government to stay here in the United States. We're joined by Catherine Ornstein, an investigative reporter and author based here in New York City. In the past, she has investigated human rights abuses for the United Nations and the Haitian government. She has been reporting on Haiti for the last 7 years, along with journalist Eva Rybkova. Catherine Ornstein has been looking at the case of Death Squad leader Emmanuel Constant and has located him in Queens, New York, where he lives with the approval of U.S. authorities. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be here, Amy.
Why don't we start off by you telling us exactly who Emmanuel Constant is?
Well, we should go back to September 1994, when immediately before the American invasion of Haiti, President Clinton went on national television to tell us why we were invading Haiti. He described the military rule there as the most violent regime in the hemisphere, in front of a campaign of rape, torture, and mutilation. That's a quote from his September 19 address. At the head of this bloodbath was the paramilitary and political organization, the Front for the Advancement and Progress of Haiti, or FRAP. The acronym sounds like the French word to hit. And it was dubbed a terrorist organization by the U.S. State Department and accused of thousands of murders. And at the head of FRAP was Emmanuel Constant, a CIA agent and alleged leader of the death squads. And today he's here in New York.
We know that he was paid by the CIA even during the coup. That information came out in The Nation magazine, and that FRAP was launched with the help of the Central Intelligence Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency as well. Maybe you can remind our listeners about the USS Harlan County and the involvement Emmanuel Constant had in turning it around, this boat with U.S. and Canadian forces.
Well, this incident happened in October of 1993. It's really seen as the turning point of U.S. policy in Haiti, and it's what brought Emmanuel Constant to the forefront of the world political scene. What happened was it was a U.S. ship carrying 200 non-combat soldiers who were slated to pave the way for President Aristide's return later that month. Emmanuel Constant raised a bit of a ruckus at the docks with about 35 or so members of FRAP. And as a result of this ruckus, the boat and Washington turned tail. Constant admits that he informed CIA station chief John Camborian that the affair was purely a media frenzy, those are his words, a bluff. But Camborian nonetheless, the CIA nonetheless, exaggerated the on-the-ground danger, causing the boat to turn around and making impossible the return of President Aristide later that month. And in effect, the incident prolonged the coup regime for another year.
After the coup, after the 3 years, after Aristide returned, explain briefly what happened to the leaders, where they went, and then what happened to Emmanuel Constant.
Well, all of the leaders, virtually all of the leaders of the coup regime got deals, sweetheart deals, really. They're all in golden exile. General Raoul Cedras.
With the U.S. government.
With the U.S. government. General Raoul Cedras is now in Panama, along with his second in command, Colonel Biambi, Philippe Biambi. In his absence, the United States is now renting General Cedras's three apartments in Port-au-Prince for $15,000 a month. Michel Francois, the head of Port-au-Prince's bloody police station, escaped to the Dominican Republic and later on to Honduras, where he is currently. And the United States is reportedly trying to extradite him on drug charges, but the procedure has been considerably delayed.
I remember when it was announced with great fanfare, but he remains in Honduras. What about Emmanuel Constant? How did he make it here into the United States?
Well, Emmanuel Constant fled Haiti shortly after the American invasion, and on Christmas Eve 1994, he arrived in the United States. He didn't have any problem when he came here, but evidently he caused some embarrassment, and in March, Secretary of State Warren Christopher issued what involved people have called a rather exceptional statement, declaring Constant's presence in the United States a threat to U.S. policy in Haiti, effectively calling him persona non grata. And he revoked Constant's visa. Constant's visa was revoked, and shortly thereafter, Constant was arrested, detained in a Maryland detention center. And later on that year, the INS ordered him deported to Haiti. And the case should have been closed right there, but it wasn't. Instead, we find that in June of 1996, the United States, in a startling reversal, struck a deal with Constant that set him free.
Well, Catherine Ornstein, you are revealing really for the first time the details of that secret deal. Can you tell us why Emmanuel Constant is now living in Queens?
Well, Constant is really an embarrassment to the United States. His silence is really worth the bargain. He was the CIA point man for U.S. operations with the Haitian military during the coup regime. And as you mentioned before, at U.S. encouragement, he formed the FRAP, the paramilitary organization that the U.S. had dubbed a terrorist group. He also met regularly with United States Central Intelligence Agency Station Chief John Camborian during the bloodiest days of the coup regime. And according to Constant, he also had mentors among Washington insiders, people like Bob McCandless, who was a key lobbyist for the Haitian coup regime and also for some of Haiti's wealthiest families, and who later became president of Democrats for Dole. And he also met with syndicated journalist Robert Novak during the coup regime. And according to Constant, these people also helped elevate his standing in the U.S. media to make him a viable political figure and provide balance against President Aristide. Constant, before he could be deported, sued the U.S. government for $50 million. And his lawsuit is actually, and he admits this, not so much a legal issue as it is a political threat. It brings up his assertions about his dealings with the United States and threatens to bring out in greater detail, essentially, the fact that U.S. policy was CIA policy, that they weren't two different policies, that they were working underhandedly to prevent President Aristide's return at the same time as President Clinton was officially supporting President Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
So he was suing the U.S. government. How did he get out of the Maryland Detention Center?
Well, Constant brought his lawsuit against the United States government in December of 1995, and his lawsuit claims that deportation would be unconstitutional because he would be a presidential candidate in the upcoming Haitian elections. And he also claimed, and this is kind of ironic, that the lawsuit was intended to besmirch his reputation. He amended his complaint, later on in March of 1996. And really what he did is he honed his lawsuit into what was potentially a very embarrassing lawsuit. And according to Washington insiders who were aware of the U.S. Constant negotiations, they said that the United States was stuck in a kind of a catch-22 at this point. Either they could deal with this embarrassing lawsuit, or they could deport him to Haiti, where he would effectively spill the beans. 60 Minutes had already done two features on Constant. They had asked if they could go along with him on the plane back to Haiti if he was deported. And Constant himself says, and this is a quote, he says, "They definitely didn't want me to go back to Haiti. If I were to be sent back, there would have been a media frenzy there."
Well, I should say that Catherine Orenstein has been speaking with Emmanuel Constant, along with journalist Eva Rybakova, over the last few months quite extensively. And you've learned from him, also have learned from other sources, different aspects of the story. What ultimately, though, set him free in June of 1996?
Well, in the months prior to the settlement of his lawsuit, it seems that the United States did not want to return Constant to Haiti. That's by his accounts, and he claims that prior to signing his settlement deal, they informed him of a plot to kill him should he not accept the deal and be returned to Haiti.
According to other sources you have, what else was involved with this? What else was involved with this deal?
Well, in June of 1996, with these kind of embarrassing issues on the table, and the idea that probably the United States did not want to return Constant to Haiti at this point, where he could really cause problems for what was largely seen as Clinton's one foreign policy success, Haiti. And now that Aristide had been returned to Haiti, the policy had changed somewhat. Constant found himself out of the United States' lap and really out in the cold. And they really didn't want him back in Haiti, it seems, where he could talk, where he might embarrassing revelations, or perhaps, you know, if anything should happen to him, that could also be very embarrassing.
And also, if there was actually a trial in Haiti, a lot could be revealed by the Haitian government.
Certainly, a trial in Haiti would certainly be an international media trial. He is an international criminal, and there are international media interested in him following his case. And he was already on the record as a CIA agent. So any trial of Emmanuel Constant would be a world trial. But on the other hand, with his lawsuit now, the United States really couldn't keep Constant in jail. So what eventually resulted from this is a settlement deal, and Constant was marched out of his cell in Wicomico Detention Center in Maryland in his orange prison outfit and brought to the booking section, where this settlement deal, which had been arranged between his lawyers and the lawyers representing the United States government, specifically Janet Reno and Warren Christopher, because that's who he sued, the settlement deal rolled off the fax machine, and he was required to sign it right then and there before leaving Haiti. And the deal specifically says that Constant goes free and will have the opportunity to apply for a work permit in exchange for him remaining here in Queens, checking in with INS, and being quiet about his dealings with the United States, in effect a gag order.
Saying he cannot talk to the press.
He cannot talk to the press. He cannot make public statements.
But he can remain here if he remains quiet.
That's what the deal says. And this is actually in direct contradiction to what the U.S. official line. The United States has been saying all along that Constant is imminently deportable. That was the first thing that was said by State Department officials and INS officials when he was released, and it's what's still being said. We spoke with State Department and INS officials just the other day. They said that Constant there's still an order of deportation out, and that at any day he can be deported. But in fact, the United States has renewed his deal several times, and he's currently applying for political asylum.
Well, we'll find out just what he is doing in Queens, New York. And I'll be playing a questioning I did at the State Department when Emmanuel Constant was released, hear exactly what the State Department says. Then we'll talk about a lawsuit against Emmanuel Constant in this country, and finally talk to John Conyers, who's just returned from Haiti. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Catherine Orenstein, an investigative reporter who has been investigating human rights abuses in Haiti for a number of years. Together with journalist Eva Rybakova, they have found Emmanuel Constant in Queens, New York, the head of FRAP, the paramilitary death squad in Haiti, responsible for the killings of some thousands of people in Haiti during the three-year military regime. He is in Queens, New York, with a work permit. This is the first time this is being revealed, especially the deal that was struck between the U.S. government and Emmanuel Constant on his release just over a year ago from a Maryland detention center. Just after his release last year, I had a chance to go to the State Department press briefing and question the State Department spokesperson about Emmanuel Constant's release.
Question on the release of the Haitian paramilitary death squad leader Emmanuel Constant. There are warrants for him, for his arrest in Haiti, for murder, for arson, for torture. And I know that Mr. Christopher approved his deportation. Who approved his release into the United States, and why was it approved?
I think the short answer to your question is the INS would have approved his release. I don't know the precise process. I'm sure, to be fair to the INS, there was an interagency process that occurred in which the State Department probably played a role. Why was he released? The basic answer, as I understand it, is procedural, that you can hold somebody for a certain period of time, and I believe it's 6 months.
They deport him then.
Before you really have to release the person. The decision to not deport him to Haiti was based on our assessment of the effect that his return to Haiti would have on, as if you will, a shock to the Haitian system, the legal penal system, and political system. It doesn't close all doors for all time, but that was the assessment that was made at the time.
Well, then can I just follow up with this question? Why was he released into the streets of the United States, considering he's wanted for murder, for torture, for arson?
He's under INS control, if you will. He must stay in touch with the Immigration Service. You'd have to talk to them about the precise terms of his having been actually let out the doors of a detention center. Does not have full free status. He's still under the overview, the oversight of the Immigration Service.
Last follow-up, and that is, in Haiti, if the U.S. is hailing it a great foreign policy success, restoring democracy to Haiti, and they say they want him returned to try him for these crimes against humanity, why isn't the U.S. respecting that?
Well, I try to answer that as best I can without any golden guidance to help me, but I think, as I recall from late last week, to reiterate, a decision was made that it is not in our best interests to deport him at this time to Haiti, given, if you will, the ability of the justice system to absorb a person such as Constant. It doesn't mean that he is for all time going to enjoy the status he has now, but it means that that right now we've decided it's not in our interests to send him back.
That was a State Department spokesperson, Nick Burns, about a year ago on June 25th, 1996, right after Emmanuel Constant, the Haitian paramilitary death squad leader, was released from the Maryland Detention Center. Catherine Orenstein, you are exposing where Emmanuel Constant is. You're exposing the deal he struck with the U.S. government. How does what the State Department spokesperson says strike you?
Well, first of all, that's exactly the line that State Department and INS spokespeople will tell you today. We've called both up, and those are almost verbatim the same lines that they've given us. And on an official level, that's all true, but in a larger sense, it's all bunk. Basically, the first thing that he said about the 6 month rule, the law that says that a detainee has to be either deported or released within 6 months. Well, that's true, but I've talked to lawyers who are aware of this case, and they say that there are also the law allows for exceptions to that rule. On top of that, States Department spokesmen have portrayed Constant's release as something that's desirable by the Haitian government, that he's not being returned because the Haitian government is not ready for him. And in fact, that doesn't seem to be the case at all. It seems that the U.S. is the reason that he's been here. And the Haitian government has actually already requested Constant's extradition. The United States denied that, saying that it was legally flawed. In any case, deportation does not require the receiving country to request that Constant, let's say Haiti, request Constant to be returned. For example, in October of 1995, between October of 95 and July of 96, the United States deported more than 130 Haitians, 94 of whom had criminal records. On top of that, Constant being imminently deportable, ready to be deported at any minute, well, that's just not true. The United States made a deal with Constant. Part of that deal is that if he self-deports, that's the lingo, it would be to a country other than Haiti. That's a U.S. stipulation. And the United States has renewed that deal 3 times. United States is really the reason behind Constant being here. It's not the Haitian government.
And yet hasn't the Senate just passed an amendment that says that FRAP members should be deported?
Well, this is really ironic. I'm looking at a page of the congressional record before me, and on June 17, 1997, and it's actually an amendment to the bill to reorganize the State Department that is passed in the Senate. And the wording of the amendment is demands the exclusion from the United States of aliens who have been involved in extrajudicial and political killings in Haiti. But it goes through a list of murders of right-wing people. And even though it specifically mentions FRAP, I brought this up. Constant himself took a look at this page and laughed and said, well, I'm a leader of FRAP. They should deport me then. And then he reconsidered and he said, oh, but that bill isn't aimed at people like me. It's aimed at the Lavalas people, at the Aristide people. So I think it's kind of ironic that the Senate is passing an amendment right here, which with rather flimsy language demands the exclusion of Haitians who are credibly alleged, that's the wording, to have been involved in murders in Haiti. And yet here in our backyard is the most wanted man of all.
Catherine Ornstein, what is Emmanuel Constant doing right now in Queens, New York?
Well, he is living in Queens, New York. He lives a relatively free life, although he's restricted to Queens. He's working with
Haitian... Does he stay in Queens?
I can't say. But you can make your own assumptions. He is working. He's selling MCI cards.
Selling MCI phone cards?
Selling MCI phone cards. He's still socializing with his FRAP colleagues, one of whom he mentioned to me was Guo Fanfan. Guo Fanfan is well known in Haiti. He was one of the big leaders of FRAP in Port-au-Prince. And he's actually accused of the murder of the Justice Minister Guy Mallory in 1993. And actually a CIA memo that was released in connection with the Alert Balance case that you mentioned earlier implicates Constant himself in that murder.
Tell us about a meeting that you attended along with Emmanuel Constant and what about 26 other Haitians where they spoke to Baby Doc Duvalier on the telephone?
Yeah, actually, Constant was not at that meeting. We just attended it to see what Haitians here, particularly Haitians associated with the right, were doing. It was a group of members of the Duvalier party, former senators, former military, former FRAP, including FRAP leaders from the United States, and Baby Doc telephoned. It was actually quite interesting. Everyone hovered around the speakerphone.
Where is he?
Baby Doc is in exile in France, but according to this group of people, and according to Constant himself, he's thinking of coming back. He actually spoke on Haitian radio to test the waters a little over a month ago, I think.
Going back to Haiti.
Thinking about it.
So Constant is in touch with him in France.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the Alert Balance case, a lawsuit that has been brought against FRAP and Emmanuel Constant in this country. We're joined in addition to Catherine Ornstein, the investigative reporter who has exposed where Emmanuel Constant is today, as well as the deal he struck with the U.S. government to remain free in this country. Sort of makes you wonder, the United States government went down to Panama and brought Manuel Noriega up to this country to try him in this country. Why, even if the U.S. government won't send Emmanuel Constant back to Haiti to be tried, they don't try him in this country. But we're also joined by Michael Ratner, who is an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York and who represents Alert Balance in her lawsuit against FRAP and Emmanuel Constant. And we wanted to know what these revelations about what Emmanuel Constant is doing and the deal he struck with the U.S. government and the fact that he remains in this country working and selling MCI phone cards means for this lawsuit. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael Ratner. Why don't you start by telling us who Alert Balance is, who has sued Emmanuel Constant.
Alert Balance is a Haitian woman who was living in Haiti during the coup period, had a family, a husband, living in a section in Port-au-Prince. And one evening, she was a market woman, one evening her husband was involved in pro-Aristide activities, as was she, sweeping up the not heavy pro-Aristide activities, but obviously had a picture of Aristide, supported the Aristide return. One evening, people from FRAP came to her door. They said they were looking for her husband. Her husband snuck out the back window. They then say, well, we'll take you. They take Alert in a car. They take her to a place called Titayin, which is a killing field in Haiti during the coup. And they slice her up with machetes and leave her for dead in the field. She crawls out of the field, tries to hail a car down. She has one arm hanging off. She's been sliced in the face, the back of the neck. Basically, I mean, would have died in another probably hour had she not gotten out. She gets to a hospital and eventually gets saved in a very, very unfortunately disabled form, loses an arm, big scars across all her face. And eventually, while she'd been denied the right to come to the United States a number of times during that period, eventually, through a lot of political pressure, came into the United States as a person who sought political asylum with her kids and her husband. She is still living in the United States, and I think in terms of, and then she brought a lawsuit against FRAP because of what the attempt to kill her and the maiming of her. There were FRAP offices in New York and in Florida. They were branching out politically, as well as probably in a terroristic way. And we brought the lawsuit. As soon as we brought the lawsuit, those offices essentially closed down. FRAP, more or less, at this point, has defaulted in the lawsuit. And what we sought in the lawsuit, it was a lawsuit for damages and to keep FRAP away from Alert, as well as to try and stop their activities in the United States. Once the FRAP basically defaulted, we still tried to get out of the U.S. government the documents that they had on FRAP, because when the U.S. went into Haiti in October, and even before that in August of 94, they took out huge carloads of documents about FRAP and about the terroristic activities of the Haitian military as well. The government disclosed to us in that lawsuit that they had 150,000 pages of documents about FRAP, the military, including pictures of the victims they took out of FRAP's offices and everything else. Obviously material extremely relevant to the lawsuit. We tried to get those documents. We eventually, and Catherine referred to a couple of those documents, we eventually got a few documents, and particularly the one that accused Constant of being involved with the killing of Mallory. But unfortunately, we've been unable to get most of the documents, and the Haitian government has been unable to get them as well. The United States insists on redacting or editing, censoring those documents so as not to reveal really, I think, who are the really bad guys who are still living in Haiti, as well as who their CIA agents were or operatives who were cooperating with the Haitian government. As part of that lawsuit, we also tried to take, we did take Emmanuel Constant's deposition at Wacomico in Maryland, actually. And we got an order to allow us to videotape the deposition. And when we went down there and had the video camera set up to videotape the deposition, Constant is brought down. He refuses to even sit at the table with the video camera and insists on going back to his cell. And we then got, of course, a contempt of court against Constant, but none of it meant anything because he doesn't get jailed for that. It just means he gets defaulted in the lawsuit, really. So, Michael
Ratner, I'm curious what Catherine Ornstein has to say, having met with Emmanuel Constant many times. He did let you photograph him. He's spoken to you for months now. What he has to say about the Alert Balance lawsuit and the charges that he has committed crimes against humanity and been responsible for the killings of thousands of Haitians.
Well, Constant says that, of course, that he's not responsible for the killing of thousands of Haitians or even one Haitian. He says that there is no case against him, and he says that he has been a scapegoat and a tool of the United States government. And actually, what he said to me, and which has thus far proved to be the most public evidence in his favor, is this quote, "Do you really think the United States would let me walk the streets freely like this if I had killed all those people?" And that quote kind of brings me around. Rather than focusing on Constant for a minute, let's focus on what the U.S. role has been. It's really important to remember that Constant, that Emmanuel Toto Constant, was the party boy of the coup regime. He was in the news every day. He was at the front of demonstrations, at the front of rallies. He was giving press conferences. And he was the justification, basically, for the U.S. invasion. The work of his organization was what Clinton cited when on September 19, immediately prior to sending down 20,000 American troops. And lo and behold, we find that he was our man in the CIA, and now he's got a sweetheart deal with the U.S. government that allows him to live here. What it really makes me think of, and what Constant's lawyer, Susan Bryant, said to me, which I thought was kind of ironic, is she says, the whole situation has been oversimplified to the point that it's preposterous, and there are a whole lot of people more culpable than him. And I think that's true. And it also reminds me of a saying, you know, it's better to have someone on the inside pissing out than on the outside pissing in.
Michael Ratner, what is your response to that and Emmanuel Constant's comment that if he had done all these things, the U.S. wouldn't let him walk around these streets freely?
I think at bottom, really, on Constant, there's only one issue that's going on, and that's that the CIA is going to protect its own. Francois was on the CIA payroll. They're not going to let him go back to Haiti, talk about everything the CIA did. And I think that's what's really going on, that they made a deal with him, and that's the deal for a long time. And if we look at what else they've done with regard to Haiti, it makes sense. Look at Michel Francois. Michel Francois, probably second in command in Haiti, indicted for very heavy drug dealing out of the U.S. attorney in Miami. They make an extradition request to Honduras to get Michel Francois back for trial in the United States. Since the press about that extradition request, we haven't heard another word about Michel Francois, and the chances of Michel Francois, who is, again, a CIA person in Haiti, will never get Francois back to the United States. He'll never come back. The CIA obviously put a stop to it. So I think at bottom they can say everything they want about Francois. There's not a good justice system in Haiti. There's not this. But in the end, what it comes down to is the CIA protecting its own, whether it's Francois, whether it's Constant, and then going after other people who are not its own, like Patrick Ali, the Haitian who's in jail here in the United States, who worked directly for Aristides, his security person, and they'll go after him because they want to ultimately really undermine the most democratic elements in Haiti and keep supporting their own people like Francois. So,
Michael, do you think that Emmanuel Constant should be tried here in this country, as Manuel Noriega was?
Well, I think he certainly could be. I think he could, if not for drugs, which some people have said that he was involved with, certainly under something like the torture convention, which requires us to either extradite the person who was involved in torture back to the country or try that person in the United States. So he could be tried in the United States. I think it would be an interesting trial, to say the least.
Catherine Ornstein, I want to give you the last word.
Well, I'd like to just point out an important fact. Constant is not convicted of anything. He is an alleged criminal. He is not convicted of anything, and that really brings to light one of the most important issues here. Before you mentioned that Haitians are clamoring in the streets for social justice, well, they're also clamoring for court justice. There has not been a single significant coup criminal arrested and tried in Haiti, and that's very important.
Well, Katie Orenstein, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Again, Catherine Orenstein did this investigation along with Ava Rybkova, have been interviewing Emmanuel Constant and investigating his whereabouts again. He is in Queens, New York, living in Jamaica, selling MCI phone cards, meeting with other right-wing Haitians as they organize in different ways, and not to mention talking with Bébé Duvalier. But what they're doing now is not so much the issue as what they have done in Haiti for the last, over the coup period. The FRAP organization, along with the coup leaders, François, as well as Cedras and Biambi, responsible for the killing of up to 5,000 Haitians. The article written by Eva Rybkova and Catherine Orenstein will be both in Mother Jones magazine online, and you can read that later this week or next week by going to motherjones.com, or you can also see their article on their investigation in Emerge magazine. We want to thank you for breaking this story here. Catherine Orenstein, a reporter and also author. She is writing a book, believe it or not, on Little Red Riding Hood and a feminist interpretation of it, how it has been used for social control. In fact, Little Red Riding Hood was first written the year that Haiti became independent. We ask
The year that Haiti was created.
If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. When we come back, we'll speak with Congressman John Conyers, who's just returned from Haiti. Catherine Orenstein, thank you again. And Michael Ratner, thanks for being with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. And just a few days ago, I had a chance to speak with Congressmember John Conyers, a Detroit Democrat reelected in 1996 to his 17th term in the U.S. House of Representatives, winning an overwhelming majority of the vote in Michigan's 14th congressional district. He's the senior Democrat on the House Committee on the Judiciary, co-founder and senior member of the Congressional Black Caucus, also holds the distinction of being the longest-serving African-American in the history of the U.S. House. We began the interview by talking about John Conyers' recent trip to Haiti, along with five Congress members and two undersecretaries in the U.S. government. We started by talking about those U.S. documents that Michael Ratner just mentioned, rather the FRAP and Haitian military documents seized by the U.S. military when they went into Haiti at the end of the coup regime, more than 100,000 documents. And I asked him why these documents have not fully been returned to the Haitians. I believe most of them are in the U.S. Embassy in Haiti, still heavily redacted. That would say so much about the 3 years of the coup regime and pinpoint the people who were involved with the killings.
Well, it's American diplomatic activity as usual. We come in, we seize a government's documents, and then we decide not to turn them over. Why? Well, one, it may implicate us negatively with the regime of Cedras. Two, it may reveal activities of the CIA or somebody else, maybe the embassy itself, although I have a very high regard for Ambassador Swing. Or maybe something else that I don't even know about. I mean, when you keep these documents and you haven't seen them, then you know, imagination comes in pretty heavily. We can only speculate. But whatever the reason, it's an improper reason in terms of international relations. You don't just do this. You wouldn't do this to many other countries anywhere in the world. But you can do it to Haiti, because Haiti is the newest, poorest, most underdeveloped nation around.
It's also the primary evidence of who was involved with FOD and FRAP, since it was their documents. We're talking about more than 100,000 pages.
Yeah. But I didn't need to go to Haiti to solve that. That problem exists between me and a Pentagon-shaped building, and I hope I'm not telling you where it is, about 2.5 miles from here.
What about the U.S. documents that are in the Pentagon-shaped building, the State Department documents, Pentagon documents that aren't the Haitian government's but ours, that may well lay out a blueprint of what happened during the coup time and what the relationship was of the U.S. government with the coup leaders?
Well, them too. I want ours and theirs brought forward.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's any hope of that? Is there any bill being introduced?
No, the legislature, boy, if I was to try to wait for Newt Gingrich's crowd to get a bill like that through, no, this is not a legislative strategy involved here. This is negotiating with my own administration.
Why do they want to hold back?
It's a funny thing, they won't tell me. Or they won't give me a straight answer. So, you know, we're back in the battle. We had it in El Salvador with documents. This is not a new, you know, activity, and this is not new conduct.
We just exposed today the whereabouts of the FRAP paramilitary leader, Emmanuel Constant. We all knew that he was in this country. We have located him in Queens and just had a reporter on who just gave extensive discussion of what he's doing. What about Emmanuel Constant, the fact that the U.S. government has him here in this country, hasn't returned him to Haiti for trial, or perhaps tried Emmanuel Constant themselves, the U.S. government, like they did Manuel Noriega?
What about that? Not good.
Do you think he should be returned to Haiti?
Well, absolutely. That's what probably some of this redacted paperwork would make clear to even the most doubtful member of Congress. So, I mean, that's just another part of the same problem. We believe that within this paperwork is enough information, maybe perhaps evidence, that would permit the Haitian government to go forward in a trial. But then that raises another question. Their judicial system is in such a state of disrepair that I wouldn't want to put up a above-average criminal attorney up against the Haitian judiciary right now. But still, that's no reason for relieving us of the obligation to forward this person to be tried by another country.
Let's talk a little about domestic issues and about police brutality, whether it's in Chicago or New York or Los Angeles. Have there ever been police brutality hearings in Congress? Has there ever been a look at taking some of these cases, like Mumia Abu-Jamal, Geronimo Prats before he was released, Leonard Peltier and others, and having congressional hearings to highlight this?
We've had hearings on police misconduct and abuse. Yes, I've held them, but we haven't looked at it from the perspective of let's go in and line up all the cases that could be eligible, that would merit revisiting. No, we haven't done that. And I'm suggesting it right now.
Is there anything you can do as a Congress member, albeit you are from Michigan, in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal calling for a fair trial? Or I shouldn't assume that that's what you'd call for. What would you call for in his case?
Well, I'm already in it and working with his lawyers to make as certain as we can that we can at least get some justice at this late date.
Moving from the issue of police brutality to the issue of juvenile justice, there's been a very draconian bill passed, to say the least, dealing with young people, putting them in adult prisons. We did a show a couple weeks ago with the father of a young man, a teenager, who was put in an adult prison in Texas, and he committed suicide there. He made it through the first prison he was in, and he was moved to a second prison where the brutality was so intense. He started off by being raped, and then he was just brutalized from then on. He just couldn't take it anymore.
It's incredible that this kind of cruelty can be going on at the levels that they are, and then to have such an intelligent gentleman as Bill McCollum of Florida, the chairman of the Subcommittee on Crime in the House of Representatives, advocating even more heinous measures in the guise of protecting us against a burgeoning population explosion of young people, which will carry with it horrendous increases in the crime rate. And then attaching to this unfalse statistical analysis a set of remedies that stagger the imagination, to build more prisons with federal money, local prisons, if you buy into his premise of incarcerating young people at higher rates and for longer terms, and he finally gave up on trying to mix adults and young people, as if anybody that could go to a library couldn't figure out what happened when we were doing that routinely in the United States and stopped it.
Let me first ask you what you think of Tony Hall's proposal for the U.S. Congress to apologize to African Americans for slavery, and then if you could tell me about your proposal for a reparations commission.
Well, Tony Hall's a friend of mine from Cleveland, a Democratic congressman. We've worked together quite frequently. He was a good friend of Mickey Leland's and succeeded him in the hunger programs that Mickey started around the world, particularly in Africa.
Mickey Leland, the congressmember from Texas who died in a plane flight in Africa.
Exactly. Tony came to me and he said, John, you know, I've got this great idea about an apology, and I want to show it to you and see what you think of it. And I looked at it, and I said, it's an idea. I said, first of all, you're the first one to advance this idea. And he said, well, will you support it? And I said, well, will you support my idea for a reparations study, which has been around since 1989? He said, well, no, John, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go that far. He said, I'm not ready to do that. So quid pro quo raises its ugly head, doesn't it? I mean, assuming that I wanted to do an apology, it would do damage to my initiative for me to say I agree with Tony, we want an apology, But Tony doesn't agree with me that we want to study reparation, not that we want reparations, that we want an examination of the subject. And interestingly enough, only one member of the Congressional Black Caucus has joined in his proposal. In the midst of the President of the United States calling for a dialogue on race, lowering our voices and trying to listen to one another, Tony Hall coming forward with the suggestion that we apologize, all of a sudden there have been a much greater interest in the notion of a study on reparations, not surprisingly, because all of these weave different threads into this whole question of the contemporary issue of race in America. How do we get on top of it? Well, can all the people who hate Clinton, his wife, his daughter, his cat, relax long enough to commend the president for starting this initiative? It is not a point getting, it's not going to get you any plaudits, not from many people, and certainly a lot of criticism on both sides of this question. Secondly, we might be able to think and discuss our way out of this problem, because the race problem is, in some respects, Amy, it's imaginary. It's what in our individual and collective minds we think of race as. I mean, it's a huge problem for some people. It's a repairable problem for other people. It's a problem that some people, if we could pull them off of some of the maniacal leadership that without solutions for other problems can always fall back on race as reliably as an antidote for their own political ineffectiveness.
Congressman, before we end, I do want to ask you about the amendment you lost last week to declassify the intelligence budget, certainly something to deal with around the balanced budget.
I mean, we're engaged in this rather farcical enterprise without knowing what is in the budget that we're balancing in terms of intelligence resources. What does it cost us? Well, we've heard what we think it costs us, and I've been assured that that's incorrect figure, more or less. It's like an open secret that we're trying to bring out into the open.
Congressman Conyers, I know you have to go, and I appreciate you spending this time with us.
Well, I enjoy talking with you as much as I do listening to you.
Congressman John Conyers, Detroit Democrat, reelected to his 17th term this past election to the U.S. House of Representatives. He holds the distinction of being the longest-serving African-American in the history of the U.S. House. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our New York engineer. Andy York, our Washington engineer. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. We'd like to hear from you. You can call us in our comment line at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. We'll play some of those comments on the air. Or you can write to us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. We are on Real Audio on the web. Just go to our website at www.pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!